Okay, very good. So welcome everybody. So this afternoon we're going to be looking at the Vammika Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 23, MN 23, according to the Sutta Central Reference System. And the Vammika Sutta is a somewhat unusual discourse in that it is, it's just somewhat unusual, really. And it mostly deals with a rather arcane set of riddles, which a certain deity expresses to a monk who then has to try to find out the answer for those riddles. The discourse has a number of parallels. And as you can see, one parallel in the Chinese Ekotarikagama. This was translated probably by the Mahasanghika school, from a text in the Mahasanghika school, the parable of the smoking burrow. Or maybe even have a translation of that. So let me see. Oh yes, we have a translation. Good. So we'll have a look, a bit more of a look at the Chinese translation a bit later on. Another Chinese translation here in the Sangyukta Agama, so this is from the Sarvastivadin school, and an independent translation here, T95. Who knows? Independent translations are usually even more obscure than most Buddhist suttas are. So that's just giving a bit of a background. So we know that this sutta, even though it's quite unusual, it is part of the corpus of Buddhist scriptures. It's not just a sort of isolated or a later invention of the Pali school or anything like that. It's part of the corpus of Buddhist scriptures, which is shared by all of the schools of Buddhism. And it's really important that we keep remembering this, even though my personal background is from the Pali tradition, and so that's mostly what I focus on. But what we're talking about is those texts and those teachings which stem from the earliest period of Buddhism. So it's not really appropriate to call these suttas a Theravadin. They're Theravadin in the sense that the Theravadin school is responsible for passing them down and maintaining them. That's true. But they weren't scriptures that were invented by the Theravadin school, and they don't have anything which is particularly unique or special to the Theravada to them. They're just suttas, texts which belong to the Buddhist history before there was such a thing as Theravada and Mahayana and all the different schools of Buddhism. And that's why they're interesting. So I'll just begin by just recapping a little bit of what we're doing in this course and some of the ideas and principles that I'm trying to share with you while we're doing this. First thing is that I wanted to shed some light and draw some attention to some of the lesser known corners of the Pali Canon. And when people read about suttas today and when people discuss them, overwhelmingly they discuss just a few discourses, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta on mindfulness meditation, and that's about it, actually. And how many books have been written on the Satipatthana Sutta? I'm guilty, I wrote one as well. And yet there's no particular reason why that sutta is so special, but there are plenty of other suttas that have great things that we can learn from. And so I feel that for me, one of the joys of the suttas, one of the things that makes them special, is that when we read the suttas, we read the unmediated response of the Buddha in the circumstances where he's encountering people and there's like specific events and things happening. And so we're not seeing a pre-digested doctrine. And the older I get, the grumpier I get, and the more cynical I get, and the less interested and the less trusting I get about things that have been pre-digested for me, okay? And when I was in Thailand, I was sick as a monk, and they took me to the local medical center, and he wrote me out a prescription, gave me some pills, and I said, "What's that?" And he looked at me with shock in his face and said, "You're the first person who's ever asked me that." Right? And so this is a sad commentary, frankly, on the Buddhist tradition. Now, this is how we are. Where people just give us stuff and we say, all right, well, I'll just take this medicine. And we don't even ask what it is. So I'm not like that, and I don't think it's a good idea. I think we should ask, what is this? What's going on? And we should interrogate our tradition, and we should see what there is of value in it. And we should find out for ourselves what matters, rather than just listening to what somebody else tells us. Now, in approaching the suttas, I'm trying to use or trying to convey a system, a way of looking at suttas that's going to be more holistic and will draw upon different angles of things, different perspectives. And just let me write this briefly on the board for you. Okay, so just to reiterate for the we got that on the recording. You can edit that bit out, can't you, Michael? Okay, so this is a set of four perspectives that I learned from one of the rabbis we did a talk with once, and they use this in the rabbinical tradition, and it struck me as being very handy to apply to the suttas as well. So that each of these is a way of looking at suttas. I don't want to say that this is kind of all there is, right? I mean, I'm sure that there are other ways of looking at things as well, but this is a useful way because it guards against certain kinds of fallacies and limitations in the way that sacred scriptures and certainly Buddhist sacred scriptures are often approached, okay? Now, the literal way of looking at a sutta, or looking at a text, tells us the is. Right? What the sutta is. The moral perspective tells us an ought. Right? What ought we do about it? Metaphorical perspectives tells us a tells us a maybe. Right? It tells us what the sort of thing can be. Transcendent. Oh, it tells us a question mark. Anyway, so when people are reading the suttas or interpreting them, then often you find that people will present one or other of these perspectives. And it's not wrong to present one or other of these perspectives, but what is wrong is when you get trapped into that perspective and you don't see that you're only looking at it from one way and you're not alert to and mindful of the fact that there are multiple different dimensions and multiple different ways of reading it. And so from a literal point of view, so you often find a literal point of view is emphasized by academics, by linguists, scholars, historians, and so on. But also, I find a lot of people, even like monks and people who come to Buddhism from like science backgrounds and engineering backgrounds, then they tend to always read things very literally, right? I come from a background in literature and philosophy, and we're trained and taught to approach text in a much more fluid way, a much more rich way. But if you come from that way where you've been trained to look at it only literally, then that's all you're going to see, and you're just going to not notice the other dimensions of the text. So seeing things literally is good. It's important to get a grounding in what the text actually is and what it's actually saying. But you can't be trapped by that, right? The moral perspective, this is usually what you find is taught like within a tradition where the, if you like, the custodians of the tradition or the upholders of the tradition are conveying what they believe to be the morals and the values of that tradition. Okay, so they'll pick up a certain text and they'll say, the Buddha taught that we should all love each other and not harm each other, and then there's this Dhammapada verse, hatred is never overcome by hatred, is only overcome by love. And so they're using it to convey that message. Okay, now, of course, that's important. And again, this is important and an essential part of it. But the problem here is that if we only look at it from that point of view, what tends to happen is that we assume that our values are the values of the text, and we read those values into the text. Now, we might be right, okay, but we don't have any way of checking that. So this is where we have to learn to use the literal reading as well, because the literal reading allows us to see, actually, is that what that text is in fact saying? And there are cases where it isn't. And so, from my own background, I mentioned before I did a book on mindfulness and wrote a book called The History of Mindfulness. And one of the things that I discovered doing the research for that is that, you know, everybody was saying that mindfulness is about vipassana, it's about an insight practice. Whereas what I discovered, to my surprise, was that in the suttas, there's virtually no association between mindfulness and insight. Let me repeat that. In the suttas, there's virtually no association between mindfulness and insight. Right? Yet we always assume that that's the case. And so if we're teaching it, we say, oh, develop mindfulness to make insight. That's actually not what the suttas say. The suttas say develop mindfulness to develop samadhi. Yeah? But if we're not ready to look at the suttas literally and to really examine them, what exactly are they saying, then we can never check that and we can never test that. Okay? So this is a limitation of that way of looking at things. Then there's a way of looking at things which is metaphorical or creative. Okay? Now, metaphorical and creative teachings are also really important. It's really essential. Because if you're just stuck on literal meanings and moral meanings, you get very boring very quickly. Oh my God, you're just endlessly repeating the same sermon again and again and again, right? And then everybody just falls asleep. And everybody's like, oh, that's very worthy, it's very nice. You can't fault it, right? But there's also no there. There's no life to it. When the Buddha was teaching, as we'll see in the Vamika Sutta, he wasn't just sort of intoning the same thing again and again in every circumstance. He was being creative with it, was drawing out new meanings and playing with it. And so there's that idea that you can play with interpretations and read them in creative ways, which is great. But the problem there is that we often forget that that's what we're doing. So people read texts in a creative or a playful way, but they don't, because they haven't done the work to look at it. Oh, there's my writing there. Anyway, they haven't done the work to look at it literally, to figure out what the text is actually saying. So they don't even know that they're playing with it. They don't even know that what they're talking about is, in fact, metaphors derived from the text, not what the text is saying at all. And a common example of that in modern Buddhism is teachings on dependent origination. And how many times do we hear teachers saying, oh, the Buddha taught dependent origination as, you know, awareness in this present life of arising and passing of things. That's not what it means at all. Dependent origination in the suttas is about how rebirth happens without a soul. That's the point of it. That's the literal meaning of dependent origination, is to look at the process of rebirth and the ongoing flow of samsara. How do we explain that without having a self or a soul to explain it? It's a literal meaning of dependent origination. Now, if you want to take that literal meaning and play with it and say we can apply those same principles in a different context, and we can draw it out and we can apply it in the context of environmentalism or the context of economics, great, right? That's what a tradition is. Tradition should be responding to teachings in a creative and playful manner. Terrific. But be aware of the fact that that's what you're doing, right? Don't just suddenly imagine that your metaphorical reading is what the text is saying. Don't mistake the metaphor for the reality. And if you don't have the discipline or the learning to actually realize that, then you'll never know when you're playing with metaphors and when you're actually talking about what the same thing the Buddha was talking about. And finally, the transcendent teaching. Okay, so again, each text can and should be read from a transcendent point of view. Now, a transcendent point of view means seeing it in terms of Nibbana, seeing it in terms of the Four Noble Truths, seeing it in terms of freedom, seeing it in terms of liberation. And it's very important that we keep that context there, right? So we can look at a text literally, right, from the point of view of a linguist or a historian or something, but we're not just interested in linguistics, right? I mean, we can learn about a text from linguistics, but that's not all there is to it. We can look at it from a moral point of view, tell us how we should live our lives, which is good, and the practical side of things is good. But Buddhism isn't just a practical ethics, right? Actually, I don't need Buddhism to tell me to be kind to people, right? There's more to it than that. It's not just an ethical system, right? And same thing with the metaphorical system. We can be creative with the mythologies and the stories and things, just as you might, you know, draw on ancient Egypt mythology or any kind of stories or any kind of cultural background and then play with and recreate it. That's true, but there's something more to it than that. So the Buddha was pointing to a higher truth, and that higher truth, the truth of Nibbana, the truth of cessation, is what all of these things are pointing to. So we shouldn't lose sight of that perspective. However, if we reduce everything to that perspective, or should I say more accurately, if we elevate everything to that perspective, we ignore the reality of life. We ignore the messy and dirty and complicated realities of the texts that we're dealing with, the times that they were in, and the lives here and now that we're applying to. And this is where we fall into what is sometimes called spiritual bypassing. Venerable Kaliko gave a talk on that a few weeks ago in Harris Park. So spiritual bypassing or elevationism, right? So you ignore all the hard work that's done at these levels and say, oh, yes, it's all about emptiness. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Ah, yes, but it's all about letting go. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And you don't actually have to listen to what's going on. And it's like if you're talking to people, again, I see this commonly in Buddhism. People maybe, if you're listening to somebody maybe who has a problem or has an issue or has a question, and then it's easy, for me as a monk, it's very easy to say to them, oh, just let go. That's the easiest thing in the world, just let go. But you're not listening to what they're saying, right? There's a difference between leading someone to be able to let go and just mouthing platitudes at them, right? So this is the same thing. We can look at suttas and passages in the suttas, and we can mouth platitudes at them, right? It's very easy to do. But to really understand that transcendent dimension of the suttas, we have to do the work. We have to do the spade work. We have to know what it means. We have to know what matters. Right? So this is, and this is something you see a lot in spiritual teachers these days, with like especially like, you know, the kind of the everything is one kind of spiritual teacher, right? So you go, oh, all paths lead up the same mountain, and everything is one and there's no difference and all those kinds of things. And you have to sort of think, well, what you're doing, in fact, is you're erasing all of those spiritual traditions. You're not listening to what any of them are saying because you assume that you know better than all of them. Right? Think about it. If you say Buddhism and Christianity are the same, what you're saying is, I'm at a higher plane of wisdom than the Buddha and Jesus. And that the things that they talked about, they talked about them as different. But I can see from my higher plane, really, that they're the same. Yeah? So this is this elevationist point of view. So it's really just imposing this transcendent dimension on things rather than listening to the scripture and understanding how the transcendent emerges from these other parts. So these are four different ways of looking at scriptures, looking at suttas. And in this course, I'm going to be trying to demonstrate each one of these and trying to approach each text and touch on each of these to some degree. And it's something that I would encourage you as a discipline, part of a regular sutta reading practice, to be able to look at a sutta and then read it from these different ways. And when you're listening to and when you're hearing people teaching on the suttas, then ask yourselves, well, what perspective are they teaching from? And then you can hear, oh, well, why does someone teach this this way and someone teach that way. And then you can realize, well, actually, this person's drawing from more a literal perspective. This one's playing a more metaphorical perspective. And then when you understand that, you can realize, oh, actually, there's, you know, each of them has something worthwhile to say, because those perspectives are both a genuine way of looking at it. Any questions on that? No? Okay. Then let us proceed. So what I might do is just read through the sutta to start with, and then we can go back and have some more discussion and look at different parts of it. So I've heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Savatthi in Jeta's grove in Atapindika's monastery. Now, at that time, Venerable Kassapa the prince was staying in the dark forest. Then late at night, a glorious deity, lighting up the entire dark forest, went up to Kassapa the prince, stood to one side and said, "Monk, monk, this anthill fumes by night and flames by day." The Brahmin said, "Take up the sword and dig, O sage." Taking up the sword and digging, the sage saw a bar. "A bar, sir." The Brahmin said, "Throw out the bar." "Take up the sword and dig, O sage." Taking up the sword and digging, the sage saw a bullfrog. "A bullfrog, sir." The Brahmin said, "Throw out the bullfrog." "Take up the sword and dig, O sage." Taking up the sword and digging, the sage saw a forked path. "A forked path, sir." The Brahmin said, "Throw out the forked path. Take up the sword and dig, O sage." Taking up the sword and digging, the sage saw a box. "A box, sir." The Brahmin said, "Throw out the box. Take up the sword and dig, O sage." Taking up the sword and digging, the sage saw a tortoise. "A tortoise, sir." The Brahmin said, "Throw out the tortoise. Take up the sword and dig, O sage." Taking up the sword and digging, the sage saw an axe and block. "An axe and block, sir." The Brahmin said, "Throw out the axe and block." "Take up the sword and dig, O sage." Taking up the sword and digging, the sage saw a lump of meat. "A lump of meat, sir." The Brahmin said, "Throw out the lump of meat." Take up the sword and dig, O sage." Taking up the sword and digging, the sage saw a dragon. "A dragon, sir." The Brahmin said, "Leave the dragon. Do not disturb the dragon. Worship the dragon." Okay? So you got that? Right? So this I mean, just sort of put your mind in this setting, right? Here you are in the wilds of ancient India, right? Not in some kind of civilized Buddhist library where you've got, like, you know, floors and things, and suburbs and concrete and light fittings and so on. But you're in the wilds of India, in the middle of this massive jungle, as far as the eye could see. And you're staying in a place conveniently named the Dark Forest. What do you expect was going to happen in the Dark Forest, all right? And so who's staying there? Kassapa the prince. Also an interesting thing, Kumara Kassapa. And he's staying there, this god comes to see him, right? I mean, you'd be like, crikey, this god has come to visit me here in the middle. It would be a pretty mind-blowing experience, right? And then this god comes and, without any further ado, just sort of starts talking about anthills and swords and bars and things like that, right? Okay, so it's a pretty out there text. So let's see what it means and see what the whether we get an explanation for it. Mendicant, go to the Buddha, this is now the deity speaking again, go to the Buddha and ask him about this riddle. You should remember it in line with his answer. I don't see anyone in this world with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its gods and humans, who could provide a satisfying answer to this riddle except for the realized one or his disciple or someone who has heard it from them. That is what the deity said before vanishing right there. Then when the night had passed, Kassapa the prince went to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side and told him all about what had happened. And then he asked the Buddha, "Sir, what is the anthill? What is the fuming by night and the flaming by day? Who is the Brahman and who the sage? What are the sword, the digging, the bar, the bullfrog, the forked path, the box, the tortoise, the axe and block, and the lump of meat? And what is the dragon?" Mendicant, anthill is a term for this body made up of the four primary elements produced by mother and father, built up from rice and porridge, liable to impermanence, to wearing away and erosion, to breaking up and destruction. Thinking and considering all night about what you did during the day, this is the fuming at night. The work you apply yourself to during the day by body, speech and mind after thinking about it all night, this is the flaming by day. Brahman is a term for the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha. Sage is a term for the trainee mendicant. Sword is a term for noble wisdom. Digging is a term for being energetic. Bar is a term for ignorance. Throw out the bar means give up ignorance. Take up the sword, sage, and dig. Bullfrog is a term for anger and distress. Throw out the bullfrog means give up anger and distress. A forked path is a term for doubt. Throw out the forked path means give up doubt. Box is a term for the five hindrances, that is, the hindrances of sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. Throw out the box means give up the five hindrances. Tortoise is a term for the five grasping aggregates, that is, form, feeling, perception, choices, and consciousness. Throw out the tortoise means give up the five grasping aggregates. Axe and block is a term for the five kinds of sensual stimulation, sights known by the eye that are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, sensual, and arousing, sounds known by the ear, smells known by the nose, tastes known by the tongue, and touches known by the body that are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, sensual, and arousing. Throw out the axe and block means give up the five kinds of sensual stimulation. Lump of meat is a term for desire with relishing. Throw out the lump of meat means give up desire with relishing. Dragon is a term for a mendicant who has ended the defilements. This is the meaning of leave the dragon, do not disturb the dragon, worship the dragon. That is what the Buddha has said. Satisfied, Venerable Kassapa the prince was happy with what the Buddha has said. Okay, so Michael, sorry to interrupt. Can I get you to turn the volume down? We're getting some ring off the volume here. Thanks. Hello. Check. That sounds better. Thanks. Cheers, thanks. Okay, so that's the sutta. We're going to go through and have a look at these different images and ideas that the Buddha is talking about here. But before we do that, let's have a look a little bit of the background and the details, and especially at that focusing to begin with, at that literal level of the text. So let's not worry too much about what the text means and all of those kinds of things just yet, but let's look more closely at what it's actually saying. Okay, so it begins with the Buddha in Sarvati, And Venerable Kumara Kassapa is staying nearby in the dark forest. And the Andhavana was a well-known forest near the Jeta Grove, where the monks and also especially the nuns would go to meditate often during the day. Often, like, it's a little bit unusual to find someone staying there. Often it tended to be a place where they would just go and do some meditation during the day. The name Andhavana is often translated as blind man's grove, and is translated, and there's a sort of fairly complicated story about there being some blind men who had found it and so on. That's what it's named after. But that's almost certainly a later rationalization. The word Andhavana quite clearly means it's a dark forest, in the sense you go in there and you're blinded because the forest is so thick. That's clearly what the root of the word must have meant. So I translated as the dark forest. I did actually have Mirkwood for quite some time, but eventually that was too geeky even for me. But that's literally what Mirkwood means, right? You know what Mirkwood is, right? What? No? Yes, Mirkwood, the forest in The Lord of the Rings, where Bilbo and the dwarves had to cross to get to... Oh, don't worry about it. It's and it's fine. Anyway, it's a forest called Mirkwood, and that means the same thing, basically, dark forest. So this is kind of a classic sort of spooky setting, right? Right? And you're going into... It's not just going into the forest or a wilderness, but a forest specifically called the dark forest, right? So it's setting up for something that's a bit kind of powerful. Now, who is this Kumara Kassapa? Does anybody know who Kumara Kassapa is? He was a prince, this is true. Interesting. And yes, there was a Buddha called Kumara Kassapa. Anything else? I'm offline. No, I'm not. No. Lords of the internet, please be kind to me. What's going on? Okay, so Kumara Kassapa was obviously a monk, and the word the word Kumara is a word that just means a boy, but often is used to mean a prince. And Kumara Kassapa appears in, of course, there are many Kassapas. Kassapa was a well-known clan, and there are tons of Kassapas. There's the well-known Kassapa the Great, Mahakassapa, and plenty of other Kassapas as well. The Kassapa fire worshipping ascetics who the Buddha met, taught shortly after his enlightenment, and many others. And because Kassapa was one of the great Brahmanical clans, then yes, we also meet a Buddha of the past called Kassapa, and so on. I don't want to kind of lay too much kind of emphasis on this, but Kassapa was, you know, for that reason, Kassapa does have a strong kind of mythological meaning. And can anybody tell me what animal is associated with Kassapa? Does anybody know the animal? Really, the lion is associated with Kassapa. Ah, okay. So that's a fairly recent thing, recent, relatively speaking. Yeah. Traditionally, it's associated with the turtle, with the tortoise. Yeah. So Kassapa is the kind of the old man tortoise. Anyway, okay. So these are some of the verses by Kassapa the prince, recorded in the Theragata. So we've just been in the Majjhima Nikaya over here. Right, so recording this sutta, the same character appears here in the Theragata, which is a collection of verses spoken by the great monks in the time of the Buddha. And the companion volume is the Therigata, which is the verses of the great nuns in the time of the Buddha. And typically in these Theragata verses and Therigata verses, most of them we find are just a few short verses. And the verses here will often... sometimes they are verses which are spoken by that person, sometimes verses spoken to them or about them. So in this case, here we have these two verses apparently by Kassapa the prince. O the Buddhas, O the Dhammas, O the accomplishments of the teacher, here a disciple may realize such a teaching for themselves. Through countless eons, they obtained individual identities. This is their last, their very final body. In the transmigration through births and deaths. Now there are no more future lives. So this is like an exclamation of enlightenment or a statement of enlightenment by Kassapa, the Kassapa Kumara. So it doesn't tell us too much about him, except he was obviously a pretty enthusiastic kind of guy. So anyway, it looks like the result of this story was good. Now what you find is that in the suttas, we find these isolated incidents and often not much to connect them. And in fact, it's not uncommon to find that it's not 100% clear whether it's in fact the same person who's mentioned. They might have the same name in different suttas, but we're not 100% certain if it's the same person. And usually in the commentaries, then they will tell all the stories. So they develop a sort of a complicated background story and tell you all of their past lives and all of the narrative and all of that kind of thing. So I'm sort of deliberately leaving aside that narrative material because that stems from many hundreds of years after the Buddha. But if you want to read that, most of that narrative material is summarized in the Dictionary of Pali Proper Names. Okay, so if you encounter a person in suttas, you can Google their name or search their name on Sutta Central and it'll give you the information that we know from the suttas. But if you want to know all the long history and background, you can search online the Dictionary of Pali Proper Names, and I'm sure they've got a copy of it somewhere around here by the great Sri Lankan scholar Malala Sekara, who compiled this like two big volumes like this. Anyway, okay, so that's Kassapa there. Here, what else do we have? Here we have that Kumara Kassapa is here said to be the foremost in the foremost in brilliant speech. That's how I've translated that one. Chittakatikan. Okay. In brilliant speech. Chittakatika has this idea of like very decorative and fancy speech. Okay, so Kassapa was said to be the one who had the most fancy speech. Why is that? That's because of the other sutta which features Kassapa, which is over here in the Digha Nikaya. So we've started with the Majjhima Nikaya, the sutta that we're actually concerned with. Then we went to the Theragata, the Anguttara Nikaya, and now to the Digha Nikaya. And Digha Nikaya number 23, coincidentally, also the Majjhima Nikaya is 23, so same number. But here we have the Payasi Sutta. And the Payasi Sutta is a long dialogue between the skeptic Payasi and the monk Kumara Kassapa. Okay, so here it says, Venerable Kassapa the prince was wandering the land of the Kosalans together with a large sangha of 500 mendicants. This actually is very unusual. We quite commonly find the Buddha wandering with a large group of monks like that, but it's rare that we find just one disciple. We might find like Sariputra Moggallana or something, but anyway, it's a sign that even though this monk Kumara the prince isn't so well known, he obviously was quite a senior and quite respected teacher. Now, I won't go through the Payasi Sutta in detail, just to comment that the Payasi Sutta, like the Vamika Sutta, contains a rather large amount of quite florid and complicated imagery and details. And like the Vamika Sutta, it requires, you know, quite a literary turn. And so it seems to be why he was described as being the one of the most brilliant speech. Interestingly also, the Payasi Sutta is the only Buddhist sutta that's so far been recorded to have a Jain parallel. Okay, so when we look at these parallels, we frequently find they have Chinese parallels and so on and so forth. And we rarely find that they have an actual Jain parallel. And so that's what this one here is. Let's see what information we get there. It's actually from the Jain canon, the story of Payasi. So there's actually a Jain sutta, which they passed down, that also featured Payasi, the same name with a different spelling, and had a very similar story. So that's quite interesting, and there's obviously a history to that. So I won't go into that too much, since that's not our main concern here. And I will just look briefly at... okay, so his name also occurs in the Vinaya, and so we've now gone from the Majjhima Nikaya to the Theragata to the Anguttara Nikaya to learn about his brilliant speech, to the Digha Nikaya 23 to learn about Kassapa debating with the skeptic, and then finally to the Vinaya, the first chapter of the Khandakas, where we learn about his role in the Vinaya. And in this one, it says that on that occasion, Venerable Kassapa took his full ordination when he was 20 years from conception. Okay, so there's a monk's rule that we can only take ordained when we're 20 years old. All right, so then the question arose in his mind. The Buddha's laid down this rule saying that you should not give the ordination to somebody who is less than 20 years old. But I'm 20 years old from conception. Does that mean my ordination is correct or not? Right? I can see Tina's smiling there. She understands these legal questions. Yes. So this is the legal procedures. Now we have to define our terms. So then he told the Buddha about this, and the Buddha said, and the exact response the Buddha gives here is, from the time that the first thought arises in the mother's womb, the first consciousness manifests, from that is considered your birth. Okay? So I allow... Yes, good question. I allow going forth... to give you going forth of someone from 20 years from conception. Okay? So this is interesting, and it's obviously, you know, quite a relevant passage in understanding questions like, you know, what is conception, when does it take place, and so on, which are important questions. So this, from a Buddhist point of view, conception doesn't necessarily happen biologically, but it happens when the first consciousness arises. Right? And so how do you know when the first consciousness arises? Well, good luck. No, because it's not the mother's thought. It's a consciousness arising in the mother's belly. Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't necessarily solve that problem, but it's an interesting to see that was what mattered to the Buddha. So essentially that means that, I think usually we take it if you're 19 years old and 6 months, then you can take ordination, something like that. So you don't have to actually have had your 20th birthday. Okay, so they're basically the references that Kumara Kassapa appears in, and as you can see, there's not too much of a sort of through thread there. Perhaps we might think that this particular passage actually suggests that the reason that he's called Kumara Kassapa is not necessarily because he's a prince, but because he was a young man when he ordained. Because it's specific, that's what it says. That's all we know about him, was that he was too young to ordain, maybe. So maybe we're actually incorrect to translate it as Kassapa the Prince. I will have to go back and think about that some more. But anyway, that's the normal explanation, is that he was a prince, so I've kept that for now. Okay, any questions about that so far? We're doing okay? Everyone's still hanging in there? Tell me if you're not. Hanging in by your fingernails. Excellent. Right, I was also thinking about that, yeah. So that means what, you can ordain a year younger? So you could ordain at 18 and a half. Okay, so then you have this deity coming, lighting up the Jetta's Grove, and then saying this stuff to Kassapa. Now, is this deity a real deity? Like, is this actually a god that comes to see him? Is this just a metaphor for a psychological dilemma that he had? Right? What's happening here? I'm asking you.
He said that you have this experience that's often called makya.
Okay.
Where you have these, you're just sitting, nothing's happening. And then all of a sudden, bang, you get this huge vision that can last several seconds, and then it's gone. But it's extremely vivid.
So like it's like a macchiato, is what I'm hearing.
Maybe they have the same effect.
Okay.
And they're collected as trophies. So if you're a bit of a spiritual warrior, then you collect them as trophies, and then your teacher says, stupid practitioner, further away. So a bit like this, it's very similar to the story where he's almost collecting trophies, and the Tathagata says, throw them away, they mean nothing. That's what came to mind.
All right. It is pretty sudden, right? He's just there, and then all of a sudden this deity appears. So what do you guys reckon? If you read something like this, what do you think? Do you think like, oh, when's it? I've been meditating for years. I've never had any gods come to me. Maybe my forests aren't dark enough. Cindy?
What occurred to me was when you've experienced creative processes in ordinary life, things come to you. You're not quite sure where and how that inspiration or that creative idea has come from. And so it occurred to me that it was, you know, all those causes and conditions that you can't possibly know the all of, something, you know, it comes from there. You don't know all the steps and all the conditions.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting point. This certainly does have that sense to it, right? It has that kind of idea, something sort of abruptly coming. But is that a literal reading of it? Is that what the text means? Or is that a metaphorical reading? Or what are we doing here? Okay. Any other thoughts? But gods in Buddhism aren't transcendental. In fact, in this kind of dialogue, it's almost the opposite, right? I mean, it's almost the god comes and presents the worldly perspective, and then then the Buddha shows the transcendental perspective. But why do you say he's transcendental? Because of the lights and... Right. Where did he get them from, you wonder? Okay. So it came across to you like a dream, yeah? Right. And that's certainly, I mean, that's there's a lot of archetypal imagery in that list. I'm going to talk about that a bit later on, you know, and it's certainly something that if you're a Jungian therapist or something like that, you'll be like, okay. And so it's certainly speaking that language, right? So is this something real? Is this something that happened? Is this a thing? When we come to these kinds of things, I don't think that it's helpful to sort of insist on one way of looking at it or another. However, what I haven't heard from anyone is the sense that this is a story, right? It's primarily a story. We're seeing words that are conveying a sense, right? So when people tell stories, they have conventions and they have tropes and they have different ways of doing things. And clearly this is a storytelling trope, right? There's no doubt about that. This particular setting of a deity appearing, lighting up the forest and so on, this appears in dozens if not hundreds of suttas. Okay, so clearly it's a storytelling trope, and clearly in some cases it's fairly obviously just used as a storytelling device, right? We have some verses, and then this is used to sort of create a setting for the verses, right? So I'm not meaning to say that that's the only role that it plays, but I'm just pointing out that we're dealing with literature and with a set of literary conventions. So if our question is to ask what lies behind those literary conventions, then we are making an inference. What we have in front of us is that story. And so we can read it purely from that drama point of view, right? That the purpose of that story is to make an entrance, right? It's to make an impact. It's to say this is something that's amazing that's going to be happening. Yeah. So this is something which is in a way kind of lifting it up and presenting it as something extraordinary. But it's not just doing that, but it's also presenting it within a cultural context, okay? And so again, please don't misunderstand me. I'm not meaning to reduce it to that cultural context, because I think that's a lazy way of reading things. But certainly the cultural context informs how these things are framed. And these deities that appear, this particular deity is not really named, but when deities appear and give these kinds of teachings in Buddhism, often they connect in some way or another with the pre-existing Brahmanical traditions. All right, so they're using ideas or names or various kinds of things which are drawing from Brahmanical texts. Now, of course, we find that all of the Buddhist texts draw from or respond to contemporary teachings in some way, right? But that's much more so in the verses. Right? The verses are actually using a form which is responding to is drawn from the Brahmanical Vedas. Right? They're exactly the same literary forms used for verses. Now, this isn't exactly verse, but it's poetic, right? And this kind of form, normally when we find this kind of deva appearing and so on, normally it's a verse exchange. So this is kind of giving us this kind of poetic, archetypal ideas that in some kind of way are speaking to or evoking a response which is deeper or more primal than a purely rational statement. Right? Now, we find in lots of suttas that when we go and look at later on at what the teachings that the Buddha taught, those teachings are very standard. Right, the five aggregates, the six senses, five hindrances, they're taught in dozens and dozens and dozens of suttas where the Buddha teaches them in a perfectly straightforward and rational way, right? When you're meditating, you encounter these five hindrances and this is what you do to overcome them and so on. But here, the teachings are the same, but the way that they're presented is in this uniquely evocative manner. And that's what's really special about this particular sutta. And so that gives us like a resonance and a... like an echo or an aura around it, which magnifies and shows us a new perspective on what these things are. Okay? So I'm going to go through this list of similes, and I will briefly talk about the literal meaning of these different things, because the literal meaning is sometimes not entirely clear. So the first one, this anthill fumes by day and flames, fumes by night and flames by day. The Brahman said, take up the sword and dig, O sage. Okay, so right away we're being presented with this almost kind of archetypal language, this almost kind of mythical language, take up the sword and dig, O sage. And we've been presented with things that have a number of different meanings, like in the, a number of different, sorry, when I say, let me be more specific. We've been presented by things that invite multiple different readings. In the responses we just heard from people now, some people said that this reminds them of like a dream, right? And that you can see that the sutra itself is actually inviting this by pointing out this is something like, it's like fuming by night, right? So it's actually giving the idea that the fumes, right? The smoke, the clouds at night, it's evoking this kind of idea of the unconscious being the clouds at night and the flames at day being the bright light of the consciousness. So this kind of duality of the unconscious and the conscious is actually kind of suggested by the imagery here, right? But of course, as always, there's a little bit more to it than that. When we look at the background to it, when I was doing the research for this, and I found rather curiously that, first of all, because remember, at the bottom of this, we find a naga, which is a dragon or a snake, right? And first of all, snakes live in anthills. Did you know that? Yes? No? Some people did, some people didn't? Yeah. They do. Yes. And this is what I found. So there's a very cute little snake peeking out from the anthill there. That one, I think, is actually in Africa. But the anthills, as the home of Nagas, are still worshipped among the Hindus. And so this is especially in the south of India. And so here's just some articles about that, special pujas at the anthills by the women devotees, mostly comprising young girls seeking the blessings of Naga Devata, the snake goddess, mark the special rituals on the second day of the Brahmostva Jatara festival. So the women devotees thronged the temple and revered the Naga Devata by placing eggs and offering milk at the anthills on the premises of the temple from the early hours of the day. Several women devotees performed special pujas at the anthills as thanksgiving to the goddess for fulfillment of vows, while others revered the goddess with great devotion, seeking her grace for good health, wealth, and children. They believe that the goddess Renuka incarnated at the anthill in the form of the goddess Yellama to offer her divine blessings to the worshippers. And so she's celebrated there. So that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. So there's clearly this cultural belief, which is of course, the worship of snakes is very common. I won't go into too much there. Worship of snakes is very common, but the worship of snakes in anthills is very common, especially these days in the south of India. The fact that it's involving a naga and the fact that it's worshipped primarily in the south of India suggests that it's a pre-Brahmanical tradition. Okay? So it suggests that it stems from the very old animist traditions of India. And snake worship, of course, is one of the oldest forms of religious worship. So when people ask me, you know, what's the most popular religion in India or the most popular religion in Thailand or something like that, they always say it's the same as it's always been. It's animism. The most popular religion around the world is animism. It's the worship of local spirits. In Chinese houses, they have the little ancestor worship shrine. In front of Thai houses, they have the spirit worship shrine. And even though people call themselves Buddhists or Hindus or Jains or Muslims, In fact, they keep their animist worship going alongside all those things. So this sutta, as well as answering to those, so again, just I want you to notice here something about the way that you responded to this. So when I ask you, you know, what kind of impression did you get from this sutta, you responded in terms of, you know, it reminded me of dreams because somebody's interested in dreaming, right? We know about, you know, modern psychology and dreaming and the importance of symbolism and so on. Somebody else responded, oh, it's like a meditation experience that I've heard about in Zen, because that's their experience. Yeah? But what you didn't say was, oh, it reminds me of the Hindu practice, the Brahmanical practice of snake worship and anthills, right? Because your particular conditioning hasn't conditioned you to see those things, right? This is why we emphasize the literal importance of things. Because if we don't take the time and the effort to study it, we miss the obvious. And to the people that the Buddha was talking about, they'd never heard of Jungian psychology. They had never heard of Zen retreats. But you can betcha they'd heard of this. They'd heard of worshipping nagas in anthills. Yeah. Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, look, psychologically, it's fantastic, right? Because he's going down deeper and deeper layers to the unconscious. I mean, it's a great thing. But then you can see it actually, it's not just, see, we tend to reduce things to what we've known before. But you see, this is actually an element of the landscape. It's not just an idea that they had. This is what they would have seen in the landscape. It would have probably been a common sight. Actually, we don't find it referred to that often in the time of the Buddha, but probably because it was just taken for granted, right? But this kind of thing would have been a common sight. No? Yeah. Hmm. Right. Right, right. Right. Yeah, something like that. And but that's another, that also reminds me of Jung, because that's that idea that Jung had, which was that the purpose of a church or a temple is not a house for God, but a prison for God. Because God is way too dangerous to let him loose. Right? And so this actually encapsulates that the spiritual power is the snake living at the bottom of it. So yeah, like you're saying, it gives you can worship him, but at a kind of safe distance. Yeah. In the old days, of course, in the Christian tradition, Abrahamic tradition, then they'd worship the God on the plains under the sky, and there's like the thunders crashing down, and you've got these kind of wild nomadic tribesmen on shrines sort of slaughtering goats and covered in blood as God crashes down his thunder and lightning all around them, right? I mean, it's pretty intense. Yeah, so as time goes on, we like to tame God and we like to civilize him. We sort of say, oh, please, God, come and live in this little house. We made a nice little house for you. And instead of, like, you know, slashing the throat of a heifer under the light of a full moon while the lightning crashes around and we send up the smoke to God because he likes the taste of it, we'll invite you to, you know, sit down in the garden and have a nice cup of tea and cucumber sandwiches. All right? And so we like to civilize our religious life, but it's an important part of the metaphor is that there is something really dangerous in that, right? Spiritual life actually has something very dangerous about it. Okay. So.
For the termites of the nest.
I know, right?
You know, they just live their lives and the cobra or whatever snake actually lives in harmony, probably protects them. So if you look at it ecologically, you think, how could people go come up with all these crazy things.
And the poor little ants don't even get a mention in the sutta, right? It's just the ant hill that people care about. I'm not sure whether they would be live ant hills or would they be dead ant hills that the snake lives in. Right, yeah. You'd think that the termites would go on.
After they leave, the ants.
The snakes come in. The snakes come in after they're gone. So that's all right.
The snake actually has a role in ecology. So when you look at it from a modern perspective, you wonder what becomes interesting in my mind, how it even evolved, you know, this kind of consciousness, these bizarre ideas.
Well, you can see, I mean, originally the idea was there was like a kind of a way of respecting the forces of nature, right? Respect and fear, right? I mean, you have to tame it. Snakes, how many snakes still kill how many thousands of people in India every year? A lot. Yeah, yeah. In India, yeah, yeah.
Asian countries, they don't kill the snakes. They say it's not good to kill snakes.
Yeah.
Maybe because of this worshipping.
I think, I mean, there's certainly, it's this sort of sense of karma, right? If you go killing the snakes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, so the anthill is fuming by day and by night and flaming by day. Brahman says, take up the sword and dig. Now, the taking up the sword and dig is also an interesting imagery. Sattamadaya is... I'm not sure if that's... take it's a fairly literal translation, but I think I won't talk too much about the imagery just now. I'll go back and talk about that later. I'll just clarify for the moment some of the more literal things. So the bar, the lungi, is that one. Here's some of the terms. The sword, something like a sticking point or a bar, but it's an uncertain term. The nice one here down is the bullfrog. Okay. Bullfrog is a important animal in the Rig Veda. And the literal word for the Pali we have here is Udmayika, which means a sweller upper. Right? So the frogs puffing themselves up. And the Rig Veda 7.103 is dedicated to frogs. So I think this is very nice. Right? The Vedas have a whole section of their hymns talking about frogs. They who lay quiet for a year, the Brahmins who fulfill their vows, the frogs have lifted up their voice, the voice Parjanya hath inspired. What time on these, as on a dry skin lying on a pool's bed, the floods of heaven descended, the music of the frogs come forth in concert like the cows lowing with their calves beside them. When at the coming of the rains the water has poured upon them as they yearned and thirsted, one seeks another as he talks and greets him with cries of pleasure as a son his father. It's quite nice, isn't it, right? The frogs calling out to each other in the rain. Each of the twain receives the other kindly while they are reveling in the flow of waters. When the frog, moistened by the rain, springs forward and the green and spotty both combined their voices. Yeah. And so this kind of imagery in the Rig Veda embodies a different range of symbols, a different senses. When the frogs are laying quiet, they represent the imminence of deity. Okay, so when they're out of season, the season's dry, the frogs are present, but you don't hear them, you don't know that they're there. And so the metaphor there is that they are like the deity which lives in all things. As they raise up their voices, they represent the Brahmins who praise the deity. When they singing with the rain, they swell with the bounty of the land. And the different frogs calling and answering each other show the connections between the diverse creatures of creation and especially the ties of kinship. So again, this is showing that when it's mentioning something like the bullfrog, that it has a literary and mythological and sacred significance, which is more than what we might just think when we just see that something's a frog calling. Now, when we point these things out, remember that we only have a tiny fragment of what was there, right? The richness and the depth of the culture and the story and the ideas and so on, most of that is all gone. And so we can just sort of try to get some glimpses of it here and there. So if we see these kinds of connections, then I think it's reasonable to assume that even in places where we don't see the connections, that the connections probably existed, right? They would have been evoking some things or referring to other things that we maybe haven't worked it out. Maybe in future we'll be able to work it out. But these kinds of resonances are found all through these texts. So taking up the sword and digging, the sage saw a forked path, dvidhapatang. Okay, so dvidhapatang literally means a forked path. And it throws out the fork. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as just fork, although I'm not sure that that's justified as a translation because I don't know whether they actually had forks in ancient India. Sorry? Patang is path, right? I mean, it's dvidhapatang is literally a forked path. And dvi is two, da is twofold path. So literal meaning is a forked path. So obviously is a synonym for doubt. Then the sage saw a box, the changarvang. Here it says milk strainer. Maybe. This is a very, very obscure word, and I don't think anybody really knows what it means. Forked path, the box. The Buddha's explanation is punning on the element vara, also found in hindrance. I think the sense of box fits this better than the commentary's suggestion of sieve. So the idea, because this in the explanation later on, the explanation of it is the five hindrances, and so the nivarana is the box. It means essentially an obstructor or a shroud or something which contains it and hides the truth. So in mythology, a box or a casket typically represents the hidden truth, especially the soul. So a soul may be extracted from a person's body and literally hidden in a box. So it's something like the One Ring or the Horcrux. So this is this idea of the external soul. So a box is something that contains something, right? And so inside that box, you put something precious. And in the spiritual path, the most precious thing is, of course, who is your true self. So then inside that is your box. But the box itself is hiding your true self. Again, I'm talking not in terms of a literal philosophy of a self. I'm talking in terms of the mythological imagery. It's hiding the true self, right? Just as the hindrances are hiding your perception of the truth. And so that simile of the box is something which is hiding the truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Please, yeah. Right. Yeah, like I said, I was using mythological imagery, where what is in the box would be your true self in the mythological imagery. No, you're basically just opening the box and looking inside. I mean, look, it's metaphor, right? So, but, yeah. No, right. The trainee is always a stream mentorer, yeah, or higher. Yep. Something like that. I'm not sure how progressive it is, but yeah. It does. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Yep. Oh, again, it's all metaphor and story. Yeah. Yeah. The suttas do that all the time, even in the more straightforward suttas. Things get repeated quite commonly. So, digging further, the sage saw a tortoise. I might come back to that later. Okay, a tortoise. So a tortoise is also a symbol for, I mentioned before, is associated with kasapa. And the tortoise is obviously a symbol of old age, old man tortoise. Taking the box, the sword and digging, the sage saw an axe and block. So the rest of these are fairly straightforward in terms of the literal meaning of it. Axe of block, the lump of meat, and then finally seeing the naga. Now I mentioned before that the naga is a dragon, but as you can see, naga has a number of different meanings. So one of the most common meanings is just a cobra. It also commonly means an elephant, right? Because the elephant's trunk sort of looks like a snake. It also is a word for a serpent or a dragon, a supernatural creature that's in a serpent form. Also a name for a certain kind of tree, and also a name for a noble person. And here it's punning on that. I'll talk more a bit about that later on. But what's interesting is that the base of the anthill, like the culmination of the journey that we've been through, is to find the naga, right? To find that dangerous serpent, the fire-breathing serpent at the base of that anthill. Yeah. And it's then that the instruction changes. So instead of keeping on digging, keeping on digging, keeping on digging, the Brahmin said, leave the dragon, do not disturb the dragon, worship the dragon. Now clearly this is showing that we've reached the end of our journey, and the naga here is the simile for a spiritual, spiritually attained person. But what's also interesting to me, and I think is quite mythically and metaphorically resonant, in mythology, we commonly find that the older gods are not completely killed when they are replaced by the newer gods, but rather that something of the older gods is incorporated into the newer gods. And this is an extremely important mythological process, and it represents also an extremely important psychological process. What it means is that when we grow up, when we grow out of earlier stages of our development, we don't just reject and get rid of those earlier stages of who we are, but we incorporate them into our growth as we grow on. And often those older gods are represented by a serpent. Here we have one of the classical, literally classical examples of this. This is Athena, who of course you all know. Goddess of Athens, introduced the olive. Thank you very much for that. And I just randomly Googled images of Athena just now, and take a minute to come up. And Athena, of course, is one of the newer gods, right? So she was the modern deity, and a deity who brought, you know, you can see from her figure, like she's beautiful, she's elegant, she's a goddess of wisdom and intelligence, she's very beneficent, she's reasonable, and she is a goddess who introduces ideas of forgiveness into the Greek legal system. Okay, so all of those things position her as quite a modern god, right? She was born also from the brow of Zeus. Right, so from Zeus's higher consciousness comes Athena, the goddess of wisdom, right? And yet if we look a little closer, what do we see here? Do we see like a beautiful pendant or some kind of glorious thing or something? No, we see this kind of slightly weird and a bit ugly little thing here, right? That's Medusa, right? So this is Medusa, the snake-headed deity. If you so much glance at her, she'll turn you into stone. Yeah? And so Athena's carrying around Medusa's head. It's a bit kind of icky, isn't it, right? Carrying around the decapitated head of a primordial snake goddess woman. Yeah? So this is that mythological process where the older, those things which are associated with darkness and with the underground, the unconscious, and all of those primeval forces, is incorporated into the more modern thing. And it's here with Athena, and that primordial forces are often symbolized by the snake. Doesn't have to be a snake, but that's one of the main symbols for it. And in this case, Medusa with her hair of snakes. You can't see the snakes that clearly there, but on other images you'll see the snakes are more clear. You see, it's not just that one off. You see, it's quite common. Here are different images of Athena here, and they all have the classical images anyway, will all have the Medusa. It's an essential part of her iconography. Yeah? And one of the interesting things I found when I was doing some research for the Sakyadita conference, and I'm going to be talking about the Aboriginal creation myth at the Sakyadita conference, the creation myth of the Blue Mountains, and that, of course, involves the rainbow serpent, who is one of these primordial deities. And the rainbow serpent is being hunted by the Kwal, and he's driven to ground after a long hunt, and during their hunt and chase across the mountains, they turn up all of the mountains and create the valleys and create the rivers and the cave systems and all of those things. At the end, the dragon, the rainbow serpent, hides in the deepest water hole, right? Again, this kind of symbolism of the unconscious, right? The deeper they go. And finally, they send the birds down to get the serpent up. And they can only get like a bite of his flesh. Right? And then the hunter, the Kwal, says, okay, that's enough. Right? I mean, he's pursued this serpent across the whole landscape, tearing up mountains and so on, his relentless pursuit for it. And then finally he gets enough. Oh, we'll leave the serpent to live. So the serpent is still living there today. So they didn't kill it. They left it there. And isn't that incredible? That's what the Aboriginal creation myth said. Leave the serpent there, down in the ground where he's still living. And that's exactly what we find in the Vamika Sutta. Leave the serpent there. So this is where mythology is so interesting and so powerful, because you can see it's revealing these truths that are found everywhere. And we can all read those truths in so many different ways and find so many different layers of meaning from them. Right? So we shouldn't reduce these meanings. We shouldn't eliminate them, but we can learn and enrich our understanding of these things by widening our perspective. And just as for the Aboriginal people of the Blue Mountains, that serpent is not just something which is talked about in a tale, but it's a living presence in the landscape. And we can see the same thing in India with the shrines, that the anthill shrines are a living presence in the landscape. And that's that feeling of the spirit and the power of nature is still there. Okay, so I've been talking for a little while now, so let's have a bit of a break, have a cup of tea, have a cup of coffee, have a bit of a chat, and we'll come back again in about 15-20 minutes for the remainder of the session.